What I'd like to do tonight is talk a little bit about resolving what appear to be conflicts or contradictory or paradoxical teachings. And in most instances, actually, it's the appearance of conflict or contradiction or paradox than the actual presence of it. And it has a lot to do with the quality and the depth of our training and the stage that we're in our practice. So a lot of this is may sound like I'm going back to fundamentals, which I am. But I want to stress a few things here tonight, because this comes out of a dinner I went to. I spoke at a sangha in the Bay Area recently, and after the dinner, there were seven or eight of us at dinner, and this very animated discussion started to unfold around a particular Buddhist principle. And everyone had an opinion about it. There were people in the room who had been practicing for a long time, really good practitioners, people who hadn't been practicing for very long. And everyone, including the newer people, were sure that they were right and very adamant about it. Okay, you know, it's kind of the what I envision to be what's happened to our society is kind of this internet mentality that, regardless of experience, everyone's opinion is of equal value. Okay, so I started reflecting on that because I had been reading a book that the Dalai Lama had come out with maybe a year or 15 months ago, and he had really stressed that the quality of our training is so important, because if we have gaps in our training and if we have gaps in our understanding, we can end up basically creating our own version of what we think the Eightfold Path is, and it actually isn't what the Eightfold Path is. And what I was struck about during this discussion was, frankly, kind of the lack of humility. You know, I think you really have to have some humility to be a good Dharma practitioner. And the Buddha was very clear and taught that there was a wrongfold, eightfold path, not just a right eightfold path. And so the idea that we can do a lot of actually very diligent work and be misguided and off course is a reality of practice. And I think it's a particular reality of being a community practice Dharma like we are, where most of your senior teachers aren't available for consultation because they're so busy and there's so much demand for the Dharma. So, you know, having good structure and good understanding around the basics and available resources becomes really important. So what I want to start with is, and the premise of this is that certain things have to be in place in order for us to be confident that we have the ability to resolve conflicts and to actually understand the interrelationship between teachings. Okay. So I first want to talk about four characteristics of the teachings and practice based on the teachings. And the first one is, and we've all heard this, is that the teachings are both profound and they're practical. They're profound in the sense that these teachings so clearly outline the actual function and structure of the human mind, how consciousness arises, how perception arises, how the mind takes those two things and what it does with them, how that leads us down one path towards suffering, and it can lead us down another path towards satisfaction and happiness. And I think the clarity of the teachings that came from an extraordinary mind accidentally mislead people to think that the teachings are either simple or simplistic. Because the more you practice, the more difficult you see that applying in our own life, some of the things that we can understand intellectually are very difficult to work with experientially. I mean, if it was as simple as understanding intellectually the teachings, we'd all be very happy, and we wouldn't be struggling very much. That's not where the major problem is. But the other piece is equally critical, is that the teachings are extraordinarily practical, because none of these teachings are philosophy per se. They are designed to be implemented, so even the most profound teaching that seems profound and it is initially hard to understand has a practical application, and that's what we always have to be looking for. And if we can't find that, then there's something off with our understanding about that particular teaching. If we can't see how it practically applies in terms of our life. So you have these very profound teachings on the one hand, you have some of these very clear teachings around the precepts and other things on the other hand, but all of them are interrelated. And that's basically the second idea, is that as vast as the teachings are, that they are a tapestry that is interwoven and interdependent. And so understanding any one teaching is dependent on understanding how they are related to each other and how they are interwoven. If you take any of these teachings and just take one strand of that tapestry out and try to understand that in isolation by itself, you're immediately going to have trouble. Now, you know, for purposes of deconstructing things and looking at them, we're certainly going to pull something out and compare it to other teachings, but pulling it out and separating it out, as opposed to examining it and then seeing how it is interwoven and relates to the other teachings, is the key element of study, and the thing that really gets us home. The third idea is that the teachings themselves, and then the practice on the teachings, where it leads you, are in a progressively deeper, more nuanced, multidimensional experience of the Dharma and understanding of the Dharma. So in the intellectual portion of understanding the intellectual framework of practice, we have to grasp certain principles before more sophisticated and later principles can be understood. And with experiential insight, we have to have certain experiences before we can have later experiences. So, I mean, this is both a question of just complete common sense and also of the fundamental aspect of Buddhist psychology, which is based on causation, that nothing appears by itself, that it is always related to and dependent on what precedes it. And so you can have eight people in the room, like we had the other night, and people are at many different stages, both intellectually and experientially, in terms of understanding certain principles, and each can be actually right from their particular stage of understanding, and missing the point that particular stage of understanding is only a stage. So how, emptiness is kind of a rage right now, you know. Guy Armstrong has come out with this wonderful book on emptiness. Alan Wallace has a book. Both of them are doing wisdom online courses. That, you know, there's a lot of this going on. And the idea of emptiness / anatta is so multifaceted that any place you are in practice, it has meaning for you if you can actually get a foothold in it and touch it and understand the intellectual framework and then have an actual experience of it. But that understanding will keep changing. It just keeps getting deeper and more multifaceted. So relating this to the idea of resolving conflicts, it's really important to understand what level are we discussing a topic. And many of the suttas, it's quite clear when you read them that the Buddha is teaching at different levels. He'll even talk about the nature of the audience that he's talking to. And you'll see that he goes back and before he actually gives the talk that he's scheduled to give, he goes through the precepts, he goes through the Four Noble Truths, and he goes through the foundations of mindfulness before he starts talking about the topic that the sutta is about. So you can tell from that it's very clear that he's made an assessment of that particular audience. And then there were other audiences, you know, particularly when he would give talks to monks and nuns, where the assumption is that the listeners have a certain level of understanding and competence, that they fundamentally understand the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and they understand karma and causality and dependent origination, so that the talks are structured in a different way. You know, he's shooting it at a higher level. So when you start reading the suttas, you know, you look for that, and then that translates into how we engage the material and if we're working with somebody else. You know, what level they're at, so that we're actually talking about the same thing. You know, like my, you know, if you could draw a picture of the discussion that we had at dinner the other night, it would be, you know, eight little heads, and they're speaking, and they're all speaking at a different level. You know, and I think everybody in the room thinks they're talking about the same thing, and at least theoretically they are. But they aren't in actuality because their experiences are different. The Dalai Lama said that when he first started teaching in the U.S., that he had to completely change his teaching style because of this principle, that he found that the U.S. audiences were just basically untrained, that they were not knowledgeable, and so that the entire way that he would frame and the level that he would teach at was different than when he had been teaching overseas before. So I think one of the implications for this, and this comes out of an interview with the Dalai Lama a number of years ago, and although it's about psychotropic drugs, I think it makes the same point, that the interviewer was interviewing the Dalai Lama about people claiming that they have significant insights and experiences on psychotropic drugs, and you could tell that the interviewer was trying to get the Dalai Lama basically to say that an insight that comes out of ingesting some kind of a plant or taking a fabricated medication was not legitimate. And interestingly, that was not his answer. His answer is that the problem wasn't that the person actually wasn't having a profound experience and a profound insight. That the experience is that the person wasn't ready for it, because they had not trained their mind to have a framework to understand the experience that they were having and how that experience fit in with a larger set of governing principles about experience. And so that leads me to my it's not particularly beautiful, but my favorite quotation from the Buddha, where he said, "I know of no other single thing so conducive to happiness than a well-trained mind. And I know of no other thing so conducive to suffering than an untrained mind. And so, in the end, this actually is about a retraining. And so our ability to understand the teachings, and as we move further down the path and engage these more challenging and profound and life-transforming aspects of the practice, really demand this underpinning of a training of the mind. We can start to have experiences, but just as the illustration of the psychotropic drugs, the mind can't hold them, the mind can't integrate them, and so what you have, rather than growth and development on the path, you have disorientation and confusion. And there's a whole stage, recognized stage of practice, where people are not well trained, have experiences beyond their level of training, and leave practice. It's this rolling up the mat and leaving the practice stage. So it's a recognized phenomenon. You see it happen, I think, at a lower level, at the community level. So I think these four characteristics of practice are at odds with two, kind of cultural mandates that we're all dealing with right now. And the first one is, and I think this, my own feeling, I just came back from a holiday trip with my family. And, I felt like very relaxed. I just had a wonderful time. I'm in a resort area. And I've been primarily doing things with my grandson and my daughter, and they were off, so I decided to look at the New York Times. And so there was one article that really caught my eye, and I started reading the article. And what I noticed was that I felt annoyed. And I was kind of watching that, and what I realized was that I was annoyed that the article was so in-depth. That it was like, well, why doesn't he just get to the point, And that really shocked me, because I've had the kind of mind that is inquisitive and curious and likes depth and, can get lost in a subject and concentrated on it for hours. And so to see that piece manifesting, and I know exactly why it's happening. It's happening because of a browser I'm using. But I think this tendency to want quick answers to things and not have to spend a lot of time getting them and not experiencing a lot of difficulty in getting them is being exacerbated by our society right now. And I think it's a tendency of mine to begin with. I think it's an underlying tendency of mine to want things easy, to want them quickly, to not have to work too hard for them. So, of course, the problem with that is that this particular practice is, in the end, based on experiential insight. It's not an intellectual insight practice. The intellectual part is critical, which I'll discuss in just a minute. But the end game is an experience which is beyond the intellect. It's beyond conceptual description. And we try to describe the experience through concept and language, but the language and the concepts aren't big enough to hold it or to adequately describe it. And that type of experience has its own rhythm. It's based on causation, where a whole set of conditions have to come together in exactly the right way for an insight to arise. And it requires an enormous amount of patience. And any of us who have done any retreat work at all know exactly what I'm talking about, And frequently, you'll think, this retreat is you know, I've been here for 9 days, you know, nothing has happened. This is, you know, you feel like you're ready to give up. You feel like nothing's happening. And in the next moment, you know, this really beautiful insight appears, or a really painful insight appears. And all of that work, you know, all of that patience of building up mindfulness, of paying attention in a particular way, begins to create the conditions where the body and the mind open and is receptive, and then allows what is to be revealed to be revealed. So there's just absolutely no way that you can force that. I mean, you can't make that happen on a schedule, which is, I guess, one of the frustrating things potentially about practice. But so I think that's a big issue in terms of like trying to resolve conflicts, because some of the apparent conflicts, the only way the answer is going to emerge is through that kind of work and patience. You may be able to come up with an intellectual answer to it, but it's not going to answer the experiential component. Okay, and then the second issue that I think is problematic in relationship to training is I think there's a natural tendency of mind to view confusion, ambiguity, and doubt as problematic, as something that we really don't want. And in this practice, those three things, ambiguity, confusion, and doubt, are really the wellspring. They're the ground from which insight arises. It's because of the confusion and sitting with it and watching it and waiting for it to unfold and seeing. All I'm getting here is a red light.
Dennis, when you tapped it, there was a slight click. There.
Okay. Is it going now?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. So just the last part of this is, when the Buddha talked about knowing of no other single thing so conducive to either happiness or misery as a trained or an untrained mind, basically, what were the fundamentals that he was talking about, and how do we translate these different qualities into a training program, even at the community level? And there's basically three components to it. And every good practice ought to have this, and I think it's a simple and good test for us looking at our practices. So the first one is basically study, or historically it was called listening. and it involved, historically, since there were no written materials, it involved listening to Dharma talks and then discussing the Dharma talks with other monks and nuns or lay people, memorizing Dharma talks, which we don't emphasize anymore. And I've always found the memorizing really fascinating, because if you just take the Metta Sutta, you know, something that's smaller, and you try to memorize that, beyond the trying to memorize the words, the fascinating experience is that through the process of trying to memorize it, you see the relationship between words, you see the relationship between ideas, and it's really amazingly thought-provoking. And you can see, in addition to the reason that there was memorization was because it was an oral tradition, you can see that there was a reason separate and apart from that, because all the monks had and all the nuns had to memorize it. And that was the reason, because it is so thought-provoking in terms of seeing the relationship. Like, why was that word used? Then another word. And why was that idea coupled with this idea? And so I would encourage you just to look at the Metta Sutta, just with that in mind. How do you evaluate a teacher in the same way? You know, that there's a set of standards. So you can just hear from that when the Buddha referred to this as training, he really meant that it was not a casual thing, that you were thoughtful and careful both about what you studied, how you studied, who you studied with, and who you listened to. So the first element of study, the second element is, not surprisingly, practice, which in this tradition is called direct experience, because we're trying to have an experience that's behind the concepts. So primarily it is meditative in nature, where we can spend the time in meditative silence to really explore something, so you can see something over and over and over again and begin to understand it in a very deep way. And then through the process that we've learned, that spontaneous insight arises. So Upandita, who was Steve Armstrong, was a monk with Upandita for 5 years, puts it this way: people in the West have been educated since kindergarten to use their intellects always to seek the whys and wherefore of suffering. Unfortunately, this kind of investigation is inappropriate for meditation. Intellectual learning and knowledge is only one of two kinds. The other means of knowledge and learning is direct and intuitive, which is the foundation for insight meditation. In meditation, one examines the ultimate realities. One must actually experience them without thinking about them. This is the only way to attain insight and wisdom relating to things as they really are, the natural state of affairs. One may understand a lot intellectually about ultimate reality. One may have read a great deal, but without experiencing reality directly, without concepts, there is no insight. So when I first read that, I found that challenging. And the more you practice and do retreat work, it moves from being challenging to being very reassuring and very restful, because you can rest into the deep silence of meditative awareness and not be worried about trying to intellectually or conceptually define it. And this is where kind of the ultimate release and letting go of this meditation process takes place. You fall into the experience that's waiting for us. So we the doing of practice is merely setting up conditions so that we can let go completely into the experiences that is there and allow it to reveal itself to us. Okay. And then once that starts to happen, then that begins to inform our daily life. Because what we're seeing in meditation and on the cushion is happening all day long, just in a different way. So once again, they're completely interrelated. There's no division between the two. So the third element, it is what is referred to as reflection or critical reflection. And this is, once again, kind of a common sense thing, but my experience is, in terms of working with people and practice interviews, is that this particular thing of the two is probably gets the shortest shrift from practitioners. So critical reflection is basically using the experience that you're having as a mirror and actually reflecting on the study that you've done and the practice you've done, and do they match up? You know, there's a conceptual model. And is the actual experience you're having the same or different from the conceptual model? And the reverse. And then you start bumping into experiences that don't fit the conceptual model or the degree to which you've studied that. So what is that? And you start having experiences that you don't understand or can't explain or fit into the model. So this reflecting back and actually looking at, you know, having serious intellectual study, setting up a framework, and then seriously studying the experience that you're having in meditation. So, you know, those of you who sit with me regularly know that I'll commonly say, as one of the introductory comments in meditation, is to see if during the sitting you can actually know what you're experiencing. So it's that actually knowing the experience that's taking place in a sitting, and the patterns and trends that you are experiencing of what you're seeing, is what ends up being the subject of reflection against the intellectual model. Now, if in your sitting that's not happening, that reflection can't take place, right? And if the way that you're studying isn't to create an opportunity for reflection, it doesn't happen. So even the study, and my contention is dharmic study is a different way of reading. That it is a reflective way of reading as you're doing it. It's an inquiry, a questioning. So, I mean, in my own case, if I find a Dharma book that I think is really a good text, it's very common for me to take a year or 2 years for the first reading. You know, I have two books right now that I'm reading. One is a pure Dharma book, and the other book is it's not intended as a Dharma book at all. It's a business book. And it's by a fellow who created the, and I mentioned this in prior talks, a fellow who created the most successful individual investment company in the history of the United States. It turns out he's a TM meditator. And other than just mentioning one line in the book about meditation, he never talks about meditation. And the whole book is Dharma. It's unbelievable. It's like taking all of our stuff and putting it into application about communication and relationship and transparency. It's extraordinary. So I'm reading these two things in parallel because I so strongly believe that they reflect each other. And my habit is to read two or three pages a week. And that's it. I go back and I read them over and over again. And I do a reflective process of the two against each other and then my own practice. So I'm not recommending that. I'm not saying that's a good model or that you should be doing it. But I think that Dharmic study is different than the way we study other things because of this reflective element. So there's these three components. There's study, there's practice, and there's reflection. And those three together work synergistically. So the study influences the practice influences the reflection. And then, you know, I could go back through, right, the reflection influences. But it really becomes synergistic. And so if you consciously try to create that model for your practice, you really feel it. It tends to keep your practice alive, and it's not as easy to get stalled or feel that you're stalled or that you're off course. So, okay, I think yes, that's about the clock is upside down, so I'm going to see what time it is. Okay, so actually, we've got some time for discussion.
So when you talk about confusion and discouragement as normal parts of the path, would that be in this process of reflection? So one reads a Dharma book or hears a Dharma talk about, let's say, certain experiences or states that one should have, and then one is not having those states or experiences in one's meditation, and one, you try different things and you try to kind of calibrate along with this, and that this sort of discouragement or confusion is ordinary. Is that how these fit together?
Well, the three that I was mentioning were confusion, ambiguity, and doubt. And I, you know, and we can tag discouragement onto that, but I think that would be one illustration. You know, is that we think we're supposed to be having a certain kind of experience and we're not. And so this for me, and the next talk I'm going to give, I'm going to invite people to send notes about what appears to be conflicts or ambiguities or the kinds of issues that we're talking about, and then I'm going to try to create a model of, like, well, how would we deal with this? And I think one of the ways that you deal with it is an honest assessment of what your practice looks like. So this idea that there are stages, and at each stage of your intellectual and your experiential understanding, it is more or less nuanced. It has a different dimension to it. So frequently people are expecting something to happen where it's not legitimate for them to expect that experience at that stage of their practice. So, part of this requires actually looking at our practice, what it looks like in relationship to a traditional practice that produces the kinds of things that we're reading in suttas and that teachers are talking about, so that we have realistic expectations. You know, I always remember this quotation from, I spent a lot of time before I was in Buddhist practice with Ram Dass, and to make the point I'm making, he would say, you know, people will come up to me after a talk, and they'll say to me, I'm Dennis, and I've been meditating for 18 years. And he says, they say that to me because they assume that that's going to mean something to me. And it doesn't mean anything to me unless I know what they've been doing. You know, like how often, what type of practice they have, how diligent they have, if they've been combining it with study, if they've been doing reflection. So, you know, you have one person who has been just sitting and doing one type of practice, concentration, for where they're at is going to look completely different from a person who has kind of a diverse practice that includes study and reflection and then different types of meditation. So, does that help at all? Am I?
Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Okay.
One of the something that you're saying that has been really pretty fundamental in the course of my life has been this recognition of the potency. And of course, I see that now, and I can articulate it quite this way, but that it always had, now I see it as opportunity, but at the time, I was able to see it as a way of breaking through sometimes, even 40 years ago or 30 years ago, and it seems that, we come to this practice sometimes, I think it was for me, because of the confusion and the doubt, which runs so rampant in the body politic or the human nature throughout, and it's such a source of fear and an inability to really live life fully. And I just wonder how we can simply bring this reality forward so people will be less scared, because this is what happens when you're a human being. This is what happens when you travel through life. And I sometimes don't know when I hear you speak about the training, as if sometimes that it has an implication that there's sort of a prescribed way to have this unfold. And part of the journey has been to discover for myself what way I have to go, and much of it comes from the teachings and the body of teachings. But I'm really resistant to, because there are three, you know, right here in this house there are three forms of Buddhism, and there's really some pretty good distinctions between them, of sorts. And I don't want to go on and on. I could just go on and on. I know you know me. So it's just, I really appreciate what you're saying, but I'm having a little difficulty with the idea that about this idea of the training, because I don't know. It seems like there's some people that really can work through and get pretty far in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think it's absolutely true, you know, that the reason the vast majority of people come to practice is because they're suffering. I mean, it's very clear that's what the Buddha said. And, I think we are a culture, every time, I give a lot of thought to these talks, and I know that there's going to be certain people, certain minds, that the minute that you say anything at all about something that sounds like it has some order to it or a prescription or particularly discipline, which you notice I didn't use the word discipline, you have a problem. I mean, we have problem, and there's a couple of people in this room, when they say this from prior courses, assigning homework becomes a huge problem. You know, like you have a beginning meditation class, and we're going to have you try to sit for so long, and then you're going to do this. People just rebel against it. So, we all have these different things. But if you look at all of the three traditions, you know, the Dalai Lama, who I'm quoting, is from one tradition, and there's from each one, there is an agreed set of fundamentals that if you do not develop competency in them, you can only progress so far on the path. Okay, so then we get into the whole issue of, well, why are we here? What does it mean to practice? So in a room like this, there are people who actually want to practice in a very clear traditional way. There are other people who want to meld some kind of, and I'm not, this is not a negative comment, they want to take parts of different things that may or may not fit together and combine it with Western psychological components that are in direct conflict to the underlying teachings, and then practice that way. So we all get to make those choices. But what I'm talking about tonight is that there are a series of fundamentals that are agreed upon, and whoever is interested in that particular approach, that there's a way to do that. Yeah. And then within that, where the freedom comes is that each one of us has an experience in that, because each one of us truly is unique, because we are this extraordinary combination of experiences during our life that have gotten us to this moment. So, I always wonder how we get as close to the same reality as we do, because you say, we all understand what mindfulness is, right? Like I've done like multiple one days, and you go around the room, well, what's mindfulness? And almost there's not an agreement on that, And consciousness is arising as our sense doors are contacting things, and that's all influenced by beliefs and prior trauma, So the truth of the matter is even with insight, this idea about levels of progression, is that we have these insights come up, and they're extraordinary, and they are partial in nature. And they're partial in nature because of our unique background. And then as we open more and more, we have other insights, and we start getting more of a whole. Each of us has to find our own way, and each of us has to find how to do that, And
Well, now that I'm disappointed and discouraged about this path that I endeavored to take, one book that comes to mind, and I just serendipitously came across it, is Joseph Goldstein's One Dharma. Would you recommend that as a resource for identifying some of the basics that you've described?
Yeah, I think that's a great book. That's Joseph's effort to show that there are these commonalities. So I think it's a great book. This last one that he came out with, which is really, a life's work, just entitled Mindfulness. I don't think you're going to find anything better than that. And you're actually not going to find too many people in other traditions that are going to agree with the vast majority of everything in there. Now, they may add things on. So for example, in this particular Theravada and Vipassana tradition, we don't use much imagination. you know, we're not imagining things. We do some limited amount of that with like metta and gratitude and, you know, projection. Tibetan practice, on the other hand, particularly oriented around the body, there's all kinds of imaginary work and for a specific purpose. So there's different ways of getting at the same material, but that fundamental material in Joseph's, that one book, is extraordinary. Yeah. You know, kind of the, just to, if you're interested in just kind of comparing notes, I think one Dharma is great because he's trying to show the commonality. Guy Armstrong's recent book on emptiness brings in threads from all of the other traditions. Reginald Ray, who is a Tibetan practitioner and for maybe the last 10 or 15 years has developed, I think, just this really extraordinary and exquisite set of teachings on the body and on embodiment. Well, you read that stuff, and I mean, it's of another nature than this practice. I think it takes us there. I think it takes us to the same place, but it is really challenging material, and he encourages you to bring in things to the practice that you would not see in this practice. So I think the danger is that, like, when I first started practicing in the 60s, you could not find a good book in English that was clear, used clear language about any of this. I mean, it was really, really difficult. You had to find a teacher to help you. Now, we've got so much, and it's become a business. So we've got people producing books, you know, to stay out front and to make money. And I'm not saying that they're not good books, but this idea that I'm trying to stress tonight about, well, there are a series of fundamentals. You know, there is study, there is practice, there is reflection. That type of thing, you know, gets lost in, you know, you pick up the wisdom catalog. You know, I mean, the choices are enormous. And there is a danger in trying to integrate that all in together, unless you're a pretty experienced practitioner. Because frequently what will happen, and like Guy Armstrong's book is a good example, three traditions will use different language in talking about exactly the same thing. Well, if you don't know that, right? You know, like at dinner the other night, there were people who had read different books and they're arguing, you know, and they're actually saying the same thing and they don't know it, right? So, I'm very much in favor of encouraging people to commit to a path and get to the point where they feel like they really have the fundamentals down, and then open up and look at other things. As opposed to look at all, you know, the other way is look at all the other things and eventually get to one path, which is actually how I got here. So you can do both, but I think the starting with all and going, it can be really confusing, you know. So.
So, Dennis, in addition to coming here on Thursday nights and going to retreats and things, you're talking about the discipline and the work that might be involved. What do you recommend that we do otherwise, at home or self-study kind of things? Is that what you're getting at?
None of this will be a surprise, right? I think you need a really good sitting practice. Right? Those three elements of study, in the last 10 years, I've realized that the study element, in the sense of studying on your own as opposed to just in a group or being in a workshop, I think is deserves more emphasis, at least than I had put on it. So I think that's important. I think having a conscious practice about integrating the Dharma in relationships and your emotional life and is another critical element. You know, the most common thing when people, you know, you would think that when someone talks to myself or one of the other mentors or a teacher about they want guidance, you would think that the most common thing that people would come and they would be leading with a dharmic question. And at least in my case, that's not the case. Probably 70% of the time people get in the door because they're having difficulty with something around emotional engagement and relationship. And how can I deal with that? And so I think it's a real weakness, and it's you know, more and more people are starting to talk about it. But I think it's the next stage of Dharma, because there is a difference between a dharmic approach to relationship and a Western psychological approach, and figuring out what those two are and how you use both skillfully, but making your relationships dharmic should be part of a really well-rounded practice. Okay, one more.
So I'm curious, you talked about the beginning, kind of at the beginning, right? So, and you talked about how there wasn't a lot of guidance. I don't know if I knew this. But you also mentioned, like, the tapestry, and I'm interested in that metaphor about how kind of pulling individual threads sort of has limited meaning without the sort of the grand view of it, which I clearly don't have. So picking a thread to start at seems overwhelming, right? And you talked about the experiential insight, which kind of is what brought me to this kind of group sit type of thing. So what value does that have, that experiential side of just coming in sort of trying to get something without the trained mind? Right?
Like, yeah.
Is this, can that be a gateway, or do I start with sort of diving headfirst into Dharmic teachings before ever expecting to get anything out of the sitting part?
Yeah. No. All of us this idea that we're all unique, although it's a cliche, it's a really important thing, because what I'm always looking for, both in my own practice when I move into some new area that I'm familiar with or I'm trying to grow or I'm working with somebody, is I'm looking to help someone get a foothold in the teachings wherever they're at. So if how you've got here is experientially, that's where we start. You know, other people have gotten here because they've read something and it, you know, it lit them up. Okay, well, that's where we start with that person. So I think we start with, well, where is some passion? You know, or where is the suffering? And then start working with that. And most people start with a sitting practice, and it's the single most important element of the whole thing. Yeah. So, you know, here what we've tried to do historically, this organization was built on the idea that we were going to offer a model that would help people progress. And before there was SIM, there was an 8-week beginning meditation course that we had, because we believe that, this isn't called Sacramento Buddhist Meditation Group. It's called Sacramento Insight Meditation. And that's because we believed that was the starting place and would always be the jewel that would hold everything else. So we started with an 8-week beginning meditation class. People started coming around that. That led to a community. Okay, so then we've got teachings on Thursday nights. Then we added one-day retreats so that you basically learn how to meditate well, begin to develop both your meditation and your experience on Thursday nights, and then to begin deepening your practice by regular one-day retreats. And then we added on a residential retreat. So then you really have the chance of like really diving deep, you know. And then when we have the resources, we try to offer other programs around the study element. So, okay. All right. So, okay, well, listen, thank you very much. I apologize for my voice being a little weak tonight. I saw Gus at Raley's this afternoon, and he was in his car and on the phone, and I had my grandson, and I wheeled my grandson up in the shopping cart next to the window where Gus was. So when I have him, it's great, and it also wears me out. So I had just cooked him dinner and given him a shower and put him in his mom's car before I came over here. So I apologize if I was failing a little bit tonight. So thanks very much for coming, and may all of our effort in the Dharma in some very real way contribute to reducing suffering in the world. Thank you.